This is music from Donny McCaslin, a composition he wrote for his hero and former boss, David Bowie. Welcome to The Checkout. It's also a podcast on iTunes, and you can listen to it on your own time. I'm Simon Rattner. It's been roughly 1 year since the passing of David Bowie, and to many, especially in the music community, we are all still mourning, including the tenor saxophonist Donny McCaslin. After he played his horn on Bowie's last studio recording, Black Star, he decided to do a follow-up and remember that amazing experience with his own recording, Beyond Now. We'll listen to Donny celebrate his mentor in a live concert setting, something we recorded at the 2016 Charlie Parker Jazz Festival in New York City's East Village. This is The Checkout. Thanks for checking in.
On January 7th, 2016, Donny McCaslin and Jason Linder came to our studios in Newark at WBGO to celebrate what had to be a highlight in their career by celebrating the release of Black Star, David Bowie's album that would then be released only 3 days later on January 10th. And little did any of us know that David Bowie would die only a couple of days later. Almost a year later, Donny McCaslin releases his own statement, Beyond Now, with the band members from that David Bowie recording, Jason Linder on keyboards, Tim Lefebvre on electric bass, Mark Giuliana on drums. Donny, thank you for joining us to talk about this recording and a year later after the David Bowie experience.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to be here. Great to be with you.
I mean, obviously, I have to ask you. And you can go to our archives at checkoutjazz.org to listen to that very unusual duo setting between you and Jason Linder in our studio playing the music of David Bowie. But did you know? I mean, you had to know, right?
I mean, it's something that's so it's so personal, you know, and so private, you know. And I know that, you know, David was very, very, a very private person. So it's something that I don't really talk about, but what I do say is that, you know, when we work together, there was never an issue with his health. It never, whatever he was going through health wise, it never got in the way of his presence in the studio and just how he kind of brought it every time. It was just amazing to see how. He just go in there and it was so focused when he was singing and, you know, whether it was background vocals or, you know, tweaking a lyric or whatever, it was always really quick and really focused and he was completely on point and he never even seemed to warm up, you know. The story that really illustrates that to me is when we did Sue with Maria Schneider.
Which is a great big band arrangement.
Thank you. Maria. Well, thank Maria.
Thank Maria Schneider. You've taken an incredible solo on it.
Oh, thank you. But we were, you know, it was like 5 or 6 hours of the big band recording and doing different takes and, you know, trying different things. And finally, during that time, David was in the control booth with Tony Visconti and
his record producer.
Yeah. And taking it all in. And once we'd gotten the full take together and, you know, maybe something had been edited or whatever overdubs had been necessary were completed, the take was complete, and I was gonna, myself and Ryan Keverly were gonna, you know, improvise over the song. But first, David was gonna put down a scratch vocal. So, again, after sitting there for 5 or 6 hours, he comes out, they get a mic up for him, and this is just gonna be a scratch vocal. And I mean, I guess he probably checked the mic for 30 seconds, maybe a minute, you know, and then they rolled the tape. And he laid it down pretty quickly. I think in one take, or he might have, you know, gone back and fixed something kind of quick. But the whole thing was done pretty quickly. And it's vocally kind of a tour de force, that piece. And then, you know, that was it. And so I had it there. Ryan and I had it there you know, to sort of play off of and whatnot. And then, you know, we did our thing and the session was over. So when that was in July of 2014. So when I heard that in the fall of 2014, I was like, man, you know, so I wonder if that was the original vocal. And it was confirmed, you know, somebody confirmed that to me. And I just thought that was amazing.
Maria Schneider's Sue, I believe recorded it around 2014.
Yeah, it was July of 2014.
And this was the first time you met him, and the relationship between you and David Bowie started, essentially.
Yeah, I met him. He came with Maria to the 55 Bar to hear us at the beginning of June, and about a week later, we had the first rehearsal for this piece. And that's where I met him for the first time.
To bring this back to sort of the jazz hemisphere, you know, a lot of our colleagues and people that listen to this music, write about this music, David Bowie is sort of the furthest thing from our radar. When he died, it forced all of us to sort of look back and revisit this discography. And we started to realize, wow, like there's a lot more jazz in a lot of this music than I almost think we all remember even. Like it was...
Yeah, that's, you know, yeah. And I remember I was with Tony Visconti and we were doing an interview and Tony said something to the effect of David's jazz influence has always been there, but it's been more under wraps until now. You know, it was more disguised, I guess, how he put it, until now. So I think that's true in my own, you know, time spent looking at his discography. I think that's true.
And you dug up one of his more, shall we say, jazzier tunes from the mid-90s that I don't think got a lot of run either.
Yeah.
And it has some, and we'll listen to a little bit of it at the top. The recording outside, where you take a tune from that recording, A Small Plot of Land, and redo it for Beyond Now. There's a lot of jazz in this, right? I mean,
absolutely, a lot of improvising. When you listen to the original version, there's like a minute of them jamming before David comes in, and it's open and it's edgy. You know, I mean, I love it. I think David Binney, who produced Beyond Now, sent that to me. We were kind of having a back and forth about different Bowie tunes to consider, and I wasn't aware of that record until he sent it over, and I was listening to it and I was like, oh yeah, you know, right away, just the openness, you know. And then he comes in with a melody, it's this really strong melody, and then again it's like this free section. I mean, it's a really...
And who was playing piano on this?
I think it's Mike Garson.
Yeah, Mike Garson was a jazz player first, I understand, or something to that effect.
That's what I understand as well. And he had a long history with Bowie.
Well, let's listen to you taking on this music. This is Donnie McCaslin's rendering of A Small Plot of Land featuring guest vocalist Jeff Taylor. We'll be right back. Taylor doing a pretty good Bowie impersonation, I have to say.
I mean, Jeff is a great singer. He's got a great instrument. And, you know, I think that's him doing what he does. You know, I don't know that he was trying to impersonate Bowie, but just to be himself. And I think he has a Bowie influence in his, you know, musical language, so to speak. But Jeff is wonderful.
Donnie McCaslin, join us here on The Checkout from WBGO. I'm Simon Rettner. We're revisiting his, I would say it was kind of short, right? Your short little relationship with David Bowie. I mean, how long did it, how many hours did you really spend with a guy all in all?
Well, I guess I would say I knew him for a year and a half.
Okay, okay. And, did you go to his house? Did you hang out with his family? I mean, how close did you get?
Well, I mean, most of our correspondence was over email, but then we spent, of course, hours together recording Black Star. And, you know, that was about almost 3 weeks of work. And then the day with Maria, of course, and he came out to a couple of our gigs after the 55 bar. He came to the CD release of Fast Future at the Jazz Standard and another Maria gig at Birdland. And I did go to his place once. I went to his place in November, and it was actually the first time that I heard Black Star in its entirety after we'd finished recording. The last time I'd worked on Black Star was in April. I went to Tony's studio and worked on it with Tony and David, and then about mid-November, I went to his place to hear it, and it was an amazing experience. I was alone, you know, at first listening to it, and it was just kind of overwhelming, just hearing everything after David and Tony had gone through and, you know, made their choices with, you know, what to include and how they put it all, kind of how they put all the elements together. And I think that the thing that stuck out to me was listening to it. I thought, like, yeah, that's what I remember. That's us. That's what we do. I hear the interplay in the band, and I hear the kind of the, and David being right in the middle of that, and I just hear kind of the back and forth going around, and it was just really a special moment to listen to it.
Donnie McCaslin on The Checkout about David Bowie and his follow-up to Black Star in memory of David Bowie 1 year after his passing. In fact, we're going to give you an exclusive right now. We were at the Charlie Parker Festival on August 28th, 2016, and captured your band, David Bowie's last band, shall we say, one and the same, and in performance. And this tune that you play from his 1979 recording Lodger, something he originally recorded with the electronic pioneer Brian Eno. You do Only Here. So we're only going to hear it right here on The Checkout.
This is Look Back in Anger.
why don't we just continue on with this David Bowie, Brian Eno phase of music? It seems like all the jazz guys are really concentrating on this era of Bowie. Mm. And that's not a coincidence.
Mm. Mm. I mean, I have noticed that, you know.
For instance, there's this incredible story that I read in The Whirlwind that I'm sure you were all like caught in, the hurricane of events following his death, because then you're going to play a 1 week run at the Village Vanguard that was already booked before even knowing he would die. And then David Bowie died, and here you are at the Village Vanguard and with his band, and you're like, what are we going to do? Mm. We have to do something.
Yeah. And, you know, just trying to figure out what felt appropriate, you know, for the moment. And
so you investigate a Brian Eno, David Bowie composition.
Yeah. And it was Jason Linder's suggestion to do Warsawa. And, we basically tried it at the sound check and then played it every set of every night.
No, that wasn't planned either.
You know, it was such a difficult time emotionally, and this tune felt like it was just a way to channel all those feelings into kind of a musical context. I mean, the whole week was, but that tune in particular felt like it was sort of cathartic to be able to play that, and felt important to me to play it every set, because of everything that had just happened and how we were. Where I was trying to come to terms with all the emotion around everything.
Well, yeah, and if we listen to the original version of this tune from 1977 on David Bowie's Low, which we will a little bit here in the background, it would be the last piece you think a jazz ensemble would deal with, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's just a very unusual kind of spacious composition. However, at the same time, Eno was experimenting with what he calls as planned accidents and the layering of all of like 430 tracks. And, you know, there's a certain amount of chaos and unpredictability in the original version of this tune.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, were you familiar with this tune before you?
I mean, I'd heard it, but I hadn't, you know, listened to it 100 times or something. I have now.
So when Jason Linder proposed to do this tune, you're like, can we go listen to it?
I said, let me listen to it again. You know, I had been listening to Low, and I just put it on, and I thought, yeah, perfect. Because the melody's so strong, and, you know, you could play it in time, out of time. It just felt like it was a tune that Jason actually put it this way. I think once he said it was a bridge between what David did and what we do. I mean, you know, it felt like a good fit for us, you know, and we could take it into a lot of different places in terms of the pacing, in terms of the energy, in terms of, you know, where we improvise. You know, it could be open, it could be short, you know, it just a lot of flexibility with a tune like that. And the melody is just beautiful, and really, I guess it kind of spoke to me.
Thank you. Let's get into your own music now. And a lot of people have said that their favorite music on this record, here you're dealing with these iconic pieces of music in David Bowie. And then you're like, no, I'm just going to write my own music in memory of Bowie. And you've been praised as that's the best music on the album, and by some accounts. These melodies that you've written, is this music that is coming to you while you are recording with Bowie, working with him, or is this after the fact?
It was after the fact. Yeah, it was in the summer after we'd recorded, you know, mostly in the first 3 months of 2015. So these songs were all written in the summer, and they do, you know, reflect his influence but other influences as well, like the melody of Shake Loose, for example. For me, I really felt like I was thinking about Kendrick Lamar and his kind of rhythmic language and the way he puts it all together. And
let's start with there. We recorded you performing Shake Loose here in the park, August 28th at the Charlie Parker Jazz Festival. Let's listen to the live performance of that right now.
Great. Thank you.
Don McCaslin performing. That's a great record, the Kendrick Lamar record, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love it.
It's very, very solid all the way through, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you friends with Terrace Martin?
I'm not, but I'm a fan.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Terrace Martin is the alto sax player that had a major input into how that album sounded, especially all of its jazz influence. You were going to say something. Were you going to say something? No?
Well, I was going to say that, you know, just different tunes, I remember different connections, like Faceplant. I remember really thinking about a tune from Syro, Aphex Twin's great record.
What tune on Syro?
I think it's called, you know, 1800 dB or something like that. It's like the fourth or fifth track.
And what about this track?
About his track?
Yeah, about Aphex Twin.
There's just something about the bass line that's really, that really was appealing to me. It just kind of drew me in, and I felt like that I'd like to write something with that kind of vibe, you know, and that translated into Faceplant.
Which is kind of an aggressive tune, Faceplant.
Definitely. It's definitely aggressive.
But you're from Santa Cruz. Where does this aggression come from?
It's funny. People sometimes think, yeah, you're the nicest guy, you're the mellowest guy, you know, but it's just inner anger, basically. You know?
With that big grin on your face. Yeah, that's pretty sinister.
It's basically anger, you know. I mean, you know, there's so many things. I mean, for me, I think it stems to my childhood and having, a less than stellar experience as a child. And so I think, you know, as an adult, you know, I've had to work on...
Okay, wait. Rewind. Less than stellar. You have to explain a little bit.
Well, I came from a broken home and, you know, like a, you know, stepfather was abusive and it was just a bad situation, you know, and as you know, when you're young and you go through stuff like that, it has a big impact on the way you develop psychologically. So I, you know, something I've had to work on, you know, and I coped with it as a child and as a young adult, but then, you know, sometimes you cope in a certain way, but then it stops being effective and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time over the years just working on, becoming a healthier person and psychologically and dealing with whatever happened to me and my feelings about it and trying to process it in a way that best suited me.
Do you think the arts or the saxophone was a vessel for therapy for you for that
absolutely.
Period?
I mean, absolutely. In a way, I mean, that was what really drew me to when I started playing jazz. It was self-expression. That was the thing that was so intoxicating for me about saxophone and jazz music was the ability to express myself and to put, you know, these emotions into a musical, you know, thing. And it's interesting because my father, he's a piano player and plays vibes. And my father loves music so deeply. He loves a Great American Songbook. And, you know, he's just such a deep, deep jazz fan. And I am too, but I feel like part of me, there's a little part of me that it's so drawn to the opportunity of self-expression. I don't know if that makes sense.
But, no, of course.
But
you're an artist. You want to improvise.
Yeah. I want to tell my story.
Exactly.
You know? So,
thank you.
Faceplant, music inspired by Aphex Twin, written by our guest today, Donnie McCaslin. We thank him so much for joining us. If you want to see him, he'll be performing at this year's Winter Jazz Festival, January 6th at Le Poisson Rouge, and on January 9th at Birdland. Check out all of our Winter Jazz Fest coverage by using the hashtag WBGO Winter Jazz. And we're back in New York City's East Village, Tompkins Square Park, where the Donnie McCaslin Group celebrates the memory of David Bowie, here with a Donnie McCaslin original, Beyond Now, featuring Jason Linder on keys, Mark Giuliano on drums, and Nate Wood on bass. Beyond Now, the Donnie McCaslin Group, paying tribute to their hero, David Bowie, at the 2016 Charlie Parker Jazz Festival. A special thanks to David Tallickson on the music mix today, and also a special thanks to Erica Elliott at City Parks Foundation for making these special recordings happen. I would also like to give a shout out to Sarah Gialletti. The Checkout radio show and podcast on iTunes is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. You can follow me at Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.